Let me just start with a case, as is our tradition in medicine. So consider this case. Abe Anderson is a 50-year-old carpenter. He and his wife are proud parents of twin daughters. And one day, Abe's wife notices his eyes look yellow. Abe goes to see his doctor. Imaging reveals a tumor in the pancreas with multiple lesions in the liver. A procedure is done to place a stent in Abe's bile duct, and biopsies confirm everyone's fears. Metastatic pancreatic cancer. What does it mean to care well for Abe Anderson? To be a good physician to him in the future that he faces? Closely related to this question, it seems to me, is another. How does the work of palliative care practitioners, I'm a palliative medicine doc myself, how does our work fit into good medicine for Abe? And these in medicine may seem like rather anodyne questions, but my argument this evening will be that the answers that are characteristically given to these questions and the assumptions that underlie those answers are wrong. I'll argue that in order to practice medicine well for Abe Anderson, clinicians will need to reject the way that contemporary medicine typically frames care for patients at the end of life and recover an older and more adequate framework. So let's start with how we got to where we are now. Since the advent of the mechanical ventilator, at least, the ethical concern most often voiced regarding end-of-life care has been how to free dying patients from the unnecessary suffering and degradation caused by the overuse of life-sustaining technologies. Patients and physicians, ethicists and theologians, the religious and the unreligious alike, have decried the way the default pathway for those who die within healthcare institutions uses life-sustaining technology to postpone death as long as possible. Have any of you guys seen this? Yeah. How many of you guys have done clinical rotations? Okay. So a lot of you. You will see it when you do. By trapping patients in a technologically driven institutional matrix that imposes undue suffering and isolates patients from their communities, this default pathway for dying poses formidable barriers to patients dying well. And the conventional strategy to address this problem has been to expand and to enhance palliative care and hospice. And so hospice and palliative care, as the two are referred to now, have been expanded markedly across American healthcare, so much so that for patients like Abe Anderson, a palliative approach to their remaining healthcare now poses a strong, if not a stronger, rival to the default pathway. It would be normal, even expected, in our day for Abe's physician to offer and perhaps even to recommend a strategy that focuses on symptom control and function and which sets aside chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. That would not be unusual today, though it might have been unusual even 20 years ago. So as a rival to the default pathway of dying in the ICU long after any hope of being restored to health has vanished, palliative care does much to help patients who are dying. How does it do that? Well, first, palliative care provides a viable alternative to the default pathway. It provides a way to get off the technological medicine train, if you will. For the most part, patients and physicians agree that whatever dying well entails, surely it entails more and less than keeping one's matter in motion as long as possible, isolated from one's community and under the control of machines and a system of processes that goes on with a relentless and unfeeling logic. The default pathway, that is, makes it hard for patients like Abe to die well because it puts off preparation for death through vain promises to extend life indefinitely. The overuse of life-sustaining technology absorbs time, attention, and resources that could be devoted to more worthwhile tasks, For example, driving back and forth to Vanderbilt Hospital leaves less time for a patient to reconcile with his spouse or neighbors. And it's difficult to pray or write letters to one's children or organize one's estate while retching from chemotherapy. Moreover, the default pathway isolates patients like Abe from their communities, and I think your religious communities in particular, that share a framework of meaning thick and strong enough to guide and support the patient in living well in the face of death. So if nothing else, the growth of hospice and palliative care has removed the taken-for-grantedness and weakened the grip of this default way of dying. But it also creates, and this is a second contribution, I think, it creates a recognizable social space in which a patient can be described as dying and not merely sick, and can therefore take on the dying role. In his book, Being Mortal, anybody read Being Mortal by Atul Gawande? Good. In his book, Gawande writes that one of our challenges in caring well for those who are dying is that it's hard to say when someone is dying. Today, it's hard. Because, he writes, technology can sustain our organs until we are well past the point of awareness and coherence. How then do you attend to the thoughts and concerns of the dying when medicine has made it almost impossible to be sure who the dying even are? Is someone with terminal cancer, dementia, or incurable heart failure dying exactly? We might ask, is Abe Anderson dying? One of the refreshing aspects of my work within hospice is that in my encounters with patients, the pretense of fixing their problem is gone. Everyone is agreed, by the time you've entered hospice, everyone is agreed that the patient is dying. Not necessarily within hours or days, but soon and for certain. And that agreement has a way of focusing attention on how to support the patient as he or she dies. For medical practitioners, what can be done now to be helpful in the face of certain and imminent death? For the patient like Abe, how do I go on in the face of and in preparation for the death that I cannot avoid? For Abe's wife and other members of his community, what does it mean to keep faith with and company with Abe on this final part of his earthly journey? Moreover, by locating the social space of dying within the geographical space of the patient's home, and by opening the geographical space of the hospital to accommodate the presence and participation of the home community, palliative care removes institutional barriers that in the default pathway of technological medicine keep patients' family and friends and clergy off balance and at arm's length. So if you've ever been in the hospital with someone who's been very sick, you may have experienced this yourself. You go into the room, you feel a little out of place, you're worried about getting in the way, you don't want to bump into something you're not supposed to bump into or get in the way of what something you shouldn't get in the way of. Now, arguably for a patient like Abe, the most important parts of living well in the face of his impending death will happen in relationship with those to whom he belongs. His family, his friends, church members. And because palliative care typically moves patients like Abe out into the community if they're in the hospital and invites the community into the spaces of healthcare, it helps to make patients' family, friends, neighbors and clergy feel welcome and empowered to contribute to what Abe needs to die well. Let's suppose that 2 weeks after his diagnosis, Abe Anderson returns to see his primary physician, and he looks tired and sad. He tearfully notes that he's not sleeping well, and he cannot concentrate or enjoy anything, not even being with his grandchildren. Because he's so anxious about what lies ahead, I'm not ready to die, Abe says. Why would God do this to me? That not uncommon presentation highlights another way that palliative care helps patients who are dying, and that is by attending to the spiritual dimensions of patients' experiences. The National Consensus Project for Quality Palliative Care identifies spiritual, religious, and existential aspects of care as the fifth of 8 core domains of palliative care. And it's not alone. From the World Health Organization, to the International Association for Hospice and Palliative Care, to the Joint Commission, contemporary visions of quality end-of-life care universally today, in the West at least, they universally include attention to the patient as a spiritual being. Something I think Thomas Aquinas would have appreciated. In all of these ways, then, palliative medicine helps patients who are dying by posing a viable alternative to the default pathway, by creating a social space in which we can say that the patient is dying and the patient can take on the dying role, by removing barriers to the patient's community, joining them in that journey, by treating spiritual dimensions of dying as worthy of attention. Palliative care does much to help patients like Abe Anderson die well. And notice that that is all prior to relieving any symptom. Prior to doing anything for his pain or other symptoms. So where then is the rub here? Well, the challenge is that palliative care also can undermine and contradict the possibility of Abe dying well. First, when it seeks comprehensively to manage Abe's spiritual concerns, palliative care risks usurping the roles that patient, family, and community play in what was once called the ars moriendi. That term, ars moriendi, it's Latin, means simply the art of dying. It refers to a literature that emerged in the Middle Ages in response to the plague, the bubonic plague. There were so many people dying across Europe that the church could not keep up with the usual rituals and practices of accompanying with those who were dying. And in response, the church affirmed and helped to promulgate a set of prints and booklets to guide lay people and those around them in preparing to die faithfully. These initial prints and booklets, they were like graphic novels, very simple ones. They were done with prints, wood prints. These initial prints and booklets expanded to a literature that was disseminated all across Europe and which shaped the way people lived and died for centuries. For my purposes tonight, when I use the term ars moriendi, I'm referring to the idea of dying well, which, as we'll see in a moment, is different in an important way from the conventional notion of a good death. For the moment, though, note that palliative care risks usurping the roles that patient, family, and community play in the ars moriendi when and if it pretends to deliver, professionally packaged, a form of spiritual care that substitutes for the part that a religious community would have played at the deathbed. I don't think anybody in palliative care sets out to do that self-consciously, but healthcare in the United States is a big thing. I was just with a colleague on the outer skirts of the campus where a whole office building has been over the past decade, steadily taken over by the medical system. That seems to be no end to the growth of American healthcare. And part of that is expressed in a growing sense that we can treat every human predicament as something that healthcare can help with, including the spiritual care that one might need or the spiritual issues one might address as one is facing death. The most problematic way, however, that hospice and palliative care can undermine the possibility of Abe Anderson dying well is by removing the conditions necessary for him to participate in the ars moriendi, to participate in dying well. Now, that is often done unintentionally. The medications that relieve symptoms have side effects. Narcotics, tranquilizers, antipsychotics. These can be very useful for relieving pain and anxiety and restlessness and breathlessness. They can also diminish consciousness and reduce the patient's capacity to be present relationally to others, to communicate, to pray, much less to engage in other activities. And in so doing, these treatments can render patients passive to the process of dying and therefore incapable of participating in the ars moriendi. So by diminishing the consciousness of patients, these treatments also put patients existentially out of the reach of their communities and of their clinicians. And this is, I'll tell you, for someone who's worked in this area for about a decade, this has been a prominent concern of many patients and their family members. In the ars moriendi, clergy, lay counselors, not to mention family members, friends, and even doctors can company with and be present to the patient in the patient's suffering. This practice of presence goes, I think, right to the heart of medicine. It's expressed in the term attending physician, indicating one who attends and makes herself present to the one who is ill. But insofar as patients' consciousness is diminished, patients' experience of the presence of their physician or their loved ones or their clergy is also diminished. So how do we navigate this tension between relieving suffering and diminishing the conditions needed for patients to die well? Navigating the tension, it seems to me, begins with recognizing that relieving suffering is not the only good at stake for patients who are dying. That when a patient is rendered unable to consciously participate in the activities of preparing for death, that patient has suffered a loss of something valuable. Hospice and palliative medicine practitioners are often in danger of not recognizing these effects of their treatments as losses, as adverse side effects. Indeed, it sometimes seems as if the goal of comfort, that word is such a powerful word in our day, the goal of comfort comes to displace all other goals, and in so doing renders consciousness and the patient's further participation in the Ars Moriendi a kind of triviality. It matters in some esoteric sense, but doesn't really matter in reality, practically. So how do we chart a way forward? I propose that to serve the Ars Moriendi, that is to help those who are dying well, those who are dying, to help them to die well, without undermining that possibility, palliation should be understood as a set of practices that are internal to medicine, rather than as the basis for a rival form of professionalized care. Moreover, as part of medicine, properly understood, palliation should be directed toward health, aiming to relieve suffering just insofar as suffering is related to health. So what do I mean here? At the outset, I asked, how does the work of palliative care practitioners fit into good medicine for aid? And I said that the obvious answers to this question, the answers that are characteristically given, and the assumptions that underlie those answers are wrong. So here we're going to begin to see why and how those answers go wrong. They go wrong first because contemporary medicine and medical ethics, to a great extent, have come to deny the idea that medicine has a rational end. An intelligible, reasonable purpose that we do not merely make up, but instead recognize and respect, and which gives physicians a standard to guide their practices. There have been times and places in which it was axiomatic that the purpose of medicine was health. Aristotle wrote, "Now, since there are many actions, arts, and sciences, their ends also are many. The end of the medical art is health. That of shipbuilding, a vessel. That of strategy, victory. That of economics, wealth." So Aristotle took these claims as basically starting points for practical reason, as what philosophers call basic, as things known immediately by both the many and the wise. Things that if you don't know that the point of military strategy is victory, you can't reason really further. If you don't know that the point of building a ship is a ship, then we can't get started, Aristotle's saying. So these are the things that we can start with. One of them is that medicine is for health. That's what it's for. That's no longer true. That can be taken as an axiom. Deep cultural shifts in modernity have resulted in widespread skepticism regarding any claims about the proper ends of human activities and identities, including the ends of medicine. Despite this widespread skepticism, however, I will not defend here the premise that the purpose of medicine is the patient's health. That's another talk. Perhaps another time we'll be able to have that conversation. But rather, what I want to do is attempt to show what that premise implies for practices of palliation and for the broader question of what it means to care well for Abe Anderson and patients like him. So if the end of medicine is health, then palliative medicine practiced as one branch or specialty of medicine will look different than what I'm going to use the term palliative medicine here just for contrast. It'll look different than palliative care practiced as a broader and alternative form of professionalized caring. Within a medicine aimed at health, practitioners who focus on palliation have a rational basis for doing things that preserve and restore health, and for not doing things that diminish health or undermine the conditions necessary for patients to entrust themselves to physicians when their health is threatened or diminished. It may seem counterintuitive to think of palliation as aiming at health. Palliation, it seems, is mobilized precisely when health can no longer be restored. Like for someone like Mr. Anderson, it'll no longer be the case that we'll probably speak of him in the language of being healthy. Yet, that way of thinking misunderstands, I think, both health and the practices of palliative medicine. True, palliative medicine is often mobilized when disease can no longer be cured. As to take Abe as an example, we know we will never again say he is healthy. Yet, health is a positive capacity. Health is not merely the absence of disease. Leon Cass memorably put this in his 1972 essay this way. The essay was called The End of Medicine and the Pursuit of Health. He described health as the well-working of the organism as a whole, or put another way, an activity of the body in accord with its specific excellences. The health of a squirrel, Cass noted, is displayed in the characteristic activities of squirrels, such as bearing nuts, chattering, and climbing trees. If you see a squirrel that doesn't do any of those things, before you've done a CAT scan or drawn blood or done a physical exam, you know that squirrel is not healthy. Because the characteristic activities of humans are more varied, so are their expressions of health. But such expressions certainly include the capacity to move one's bowels, to eat and digest food without vomiting it up, to sit or lie or walk without racking pain, to stay awake and to fall asleep at the proper times. Those are all dimensions of health that can't be reduced to the presence or absence of disease. Health is also a matter of degree. Physicians cannot return Abe to the state of health he had before his diagnosis, but if they help him along the way go from a state of nausea, constipation, insomnia, and racking pain to tolerating food, moving his bowels, sleeping 6 hours a night, and moving around free of debilitating pain, then it seems to me they will have contributed objectively to his health. And here's the key. It is just these sorts of contributions to health that make it possible for patients to engage in the Ars Moriendi, to engage the tasks of living well in the face of death. The typical tasks of dying well or of the Ars Moriendi are not physically demanding in the usual sense. They rarely involve climbing mountains or running marathons. But they do require some attention, some thought, often some communication through voice or writing, and often being present relationally to others. Those are all the kinds of things that people generally know are fitting for them as they face their own deaths. Those tasks are made extraordinarily difficult by racking pain and breathlessness, by vomiting and constipation, by insomnia and delirium. So by treating and relieving these disabling conditions, palliative medicine helps to restore that measure of health that patients need in order to participate in and not merely be passive to the task of dying well. Now, here an important distinction comes into view. It's one thing for health professionals to palliate disabling symptoms with an eye to preserving and restoring a measure of health, a measure again that makes it possible for the patient to participate in dying well. It's another thing for healthcare professionals to palliate symptoms without respect to whether doing so restores health. And I propose that physicians should respect this distinction, embracing the former practices of palliation and resisting the latter. Physicians, however, are tempted to elide this distinction or to regard it as of no clinical moral significance. So returning to our case, let's just say that Abe goes through chemotherapy. His disease progresses. He sees his primary physician and says, "Doc, I do not want to languish and suffer in the final stages of this disease. If I come to the point in which I cannot tolerate living any longer, If I ask you to do so, would you sedate me until I'm unconscious and keep me that way until I die? At a later visit, he adds, it's very important for me to have some control and autonomy at the end of my life. I don't expect I'll need to use it, but would you provide me a prescription for medications that I can take to end my life if I cannot go on? So how is it that Abe, along with the good people of Washington, Oregon, and Vermont, and a few other states, Colorado, have come to see sedation unto death or physician-assisted suicide as perhaps the most reasonable courses of action when they face the prospect of losing their capacities? There's more to be said about that than I could say tonight, but it's evident that the cultures of late modern Western wealthy societies do not form in us imaginations capable of receiving unwanted suffering, death, and the loss of control as anything other than meaningless burdens, much less capable of receiving those burdens as invitations to live well in the face of debility and death. With respect to these burdens, when the meaning is gone, the suffering remains and even is intensified. If Abe or his physician is not capable of seeing Abe's suffering, loss of control, and even dying as occasions in which redemptive purposes may still be at work, which is not, again, to glorify that pain and suffering, but that good things can still be present in this, despite the suffering, as experiences that invite Abe, the sufferer, to new and worthwhile practices, if that's not true, then the putative goal of medicine to preserve and restore Abe's health seems, frankly, beside the point. In contemporary Western culture, the only reasonable response to unwanted suffering, therefore, and more importantly often, the only compassionate response, is to get rid of it. The only way to respond to suffering reasonably in our world, it seems, is to get rid of it. And under this cultural pressure, then the medical profession has been steadily setting aside, enthusiasts of this might say overcoming, the constraints imposed by aiming only at health. And it has been taking on more expansive aims. That's across medicine, but here tonight we're just focusing on end-of-life care. Within that domain, the World Health Organization defines palliative care as, quote, an approach that improves the quality of life of patients and their families facing the problems associated with life-threatening illness through the prevention and relief of suffering by means of early identification and impeccable assessment and treatment of pain and other problems, physical, psychosocial, and spiritual, end quote. And note how that formulation gives palliative care a seemingly boundless scope of responsibility. What problems do you have that are excluded from the categories of physical, psychosocial, and spiritual? Note also that in this formulation, medicine does not aim to preserve and restore a measure of health, but rather to relieve suffering and to improve quality of life. And so comfort and quality of life become the dominant terms. When efforts to relieve suffering and to improve quality of life break free of the limitations imposed by medicine's traditional orientation to health, physicians begin to see all forms of suffering, including existential suffering or spiritual suffering, as conditions which call for medical treatment. And because palliative care in particular seeks to minimize suffering and maximize quality of life, and because suffering and quality of life can really, in the end, only be assessed authoritatively by the one who suffers, palliative care practitioners come to trade their own clinical judgment for the direction given by patient preferences. And this language of patient preferences links the goal of control over one's destiny together with the goal of freedom from unwanted suffering. The American Association of Hospice and Palliative Medicine makes this link explicit, writing, quote, the goal of palliative care is to prevent and relieve suffering and to support the best possible quality of life for patients and their families, regardless of their stage of disease or the need for other therapies, in accordance with their values and preferences. So if Abe's physician sets out to minimize Abe's suffering, maximize his quality of life, and do so in accordance with his values and preferences, then it seems that the physician has a good reason to aim at Abe's death itself as one of her goals. And a growing proportion of the public and of the medical profession has come to think in just this way. The palliative care literature speaks less about relieving disabling symptoms so that patients can live as well as possible in the face of death. It speaks more about treating unwanted symptoms so that patients can die comfortably. To give just one prominent example, the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization describes hospice as follows, quote, "Hospice affirms the concept of palliative care as an intensive program that enhances comfort and promotes the quality of life for individuals and their families. When cure is no longer possible, hospice recognizes that a peaceful and comfortable death is an essential goal of health care." So note these shifts, a shift from aiming at health to maximizing quality of life, a shift from proportionate relief of suffering, of symptoms, to minimize suffering, and from helping patients who are dying in hopes they can die well, to helping patients to die by giving them a good death, where a good death is a death that the patient chooses and which is as free of suffering as possible. Those shifts may seem subtle, but it seems to me they're quite consequential for how we think about what it's going to mean for us to care well for Abe Anderson and others like him. To put it really plainly, when the goal of medicine shifts from helping patients who are dying to helping patients to die, practices that render patients unconscious or that directly hasten their death no longer seem like last resort options. Indeed, these practices, including palliative sedation to unconsciousness, assisted suicide, euthanasia, seem to follow ineluctably from making the relief of suffering and satisfying patients' choices medicine's first principles. So why turn back? Why constrain palliative care for patients like Abe Anderson to the traditional goal of medicine, to this orientation to Abe's health? Well, boundaries help to resist against endemic temptations. Physicians who care for patients with advanced illness have long known that both they and their patients will at times be tempted to do away with suffering by doing away with the patient. This is not new. And to mitigate against that temptation, physicians have for 2+ millennia sworn in the Hippocratic Oath that they will enter homes only for the good of the sick and, quote, "I will neither give a deadly drug to anybody who asks for it, nor will I make a suggestion to this effect," end quote. Importantly, this boundary against diminishing or destroying the patient's health not only gives patients a reason to trust physicians, but it also gives physicians the freedom they need to do their work. This is something that's often forgotten, it seems to me, today. In our desire to satisfy people's wishes, we forget how doing so can undermine the possibility that future patients can entrust themselves to us. When I take care of patients and their families who are wary of what hospice will do to the one who is dying, it helps very much that I can tell them that as a physician, I am committed to never intentionally hastening or causing a patient's death, ever. That boundary creates a space in which I and other physicians can act decisively to palliate distressing symptoms and can accept side effects, including the foreseen side effect of making a patient unconscious or even hastening their death, if we have proportionate reason to do so, but only if we have proportionate reason to do so, and only if we're not aiming at their death. That is the simplest formulation of the ancient rule, the rule of double effect, that some consequences of an action that should never be intended can be accepted as side effects if there's proportionate reason to do so. That rule is necessary for us to make sense of almost everything that physicians do, because everything we do has side effects that are damaging. Without this boundary, however, the commitment to never intend harm to the health of Abe Anderson or anyone else, without that, then patients and family members have good reasons to worry that the morphine that leads to sedation is dosed not in proportion to the pain or breathlessness that the patient experiences, but in an effort to hurry the dying process along. And this question of trust is paramount. People in our plural culture have trusted institutional medicine in no small part because preserving and restoring health is a goal shared broadly across diverse moral traditions and communities. Assisting patients to die is not a goal shared in the same way. How and to what extent suffering should be treated is also the subject of widespread disagreements, particularly when that suffering is not obviously related to health. Already, the work of palliative medicine docs is inhibited by the fact that many Americans, particularly among minority communities and among some religious communities, many Americans are suspicious that palliative medicine has unmoored itself from the constraints traditionally respected by the profession of medicine, moving from proportionate palliation, for example, to rationalized processes of making people dead. And when physicians set themselves outside the traditional constraints and goals of medicine, when we fail to recognize and respect the value of what was once called the ars moriendi, we erode the public trust we need to provide appropriate palliation to patients like Abe Anderson. If and to the extent that Abe Anderson or patients like him distrust palliative medicine, they will go without all of the good that palliative medicine can do to contribute to the conditions necessary for them to live well in the face of death. So, in conclusion, medicine, it seems to me, and palliative medicine in particular, can do much to help those who are dying if medical practitioners humbly acknowledge that dying well is an activity for the patient and their community. To which medical practitioners contribute insofar as they help to make the activity possible by mitigating distressing symptoms, maintaining function, sustaining location in the community, providing realistic information, and by reassuring presence, but which medical practitioners subvert insofar as they presume to deliver a good death by removing the capacities that make suffering possible. If we set palliation within and under the constraints of medicine, rather than as an alternative to and more expansive form of professionalized care, physicians can sustain a proper humility and focus on a limited but very important role. Rather than usurping or undermining the ars moriendi, they would work to preserve and restore the measures of health that make it possible for patients to engage in the tasks of dying well. And I'll just add one other comment, because it's come up when I've talked to people about this topic before, which is something I want to be clear about. I want to be clear that I'm not saying that hospice and palliative medicine docs are out there looking to cause people's death. I don't think that's the case. I've not met any that I thought had a kind of hankering to cause some deaths. It's rather that in our monocular focus on relieving suffering, without any objective norms to guide how we do so, namely the norm of the patient's health, which is traditionally guided medicine, then we come to aim at death as a means of relieving suffering. Second thing I want to say is that I'm not suggesting that suffering, by saying that when someone is in the occasion of suffering and when someone is facing death, redemptive purposes might still be available. It's not to say that that suffering is to be valorized or glorified, and that somehow we're supposed to kind of be excited that patients are suffering because that's the way they're going to grow. Not at all. But rather it is to say that if it's not true that there are still goods at stake for Abe, despite the fact that he's dying, then it really becomes the case that it's better off for him to be dead. And I think that way of thinking, if you follow the logic of it, ends up with very problematic and frankly frightening prospects of getting rid of people who don't have some threshold level of quality of life. And history is marked with occasions where medicine has gotten into that mode, and they're all dark. They're all the kinds of things that we look back on as places where medicine's gone terribly awry. I'll stop there, and happy to take questions with the time we have remaining. comments. Yes.
When taking care of patients and discussing plan of care and goals with patients with life-threatening diseases, specifically in arenas of trauma, emergency, and critical care medicine, an obvious concern that's burdening my colleagues and I are it's a lack of transparent communication, specifically a lack of clear, intentional vocabulary that would describe the differences between advancing and continuing life-supporting measures and quality of life. Drawing on your experiences, can you discuss any solutions to this? Most of that, of course, provide an effective solution to this burden, but also more sustainable for all areas of the
So maybe, can you give me, just so I make sure I understand, maybe an example of the kind of case this comes up or the situation this comes up?
Well, with Abe, if he was transferred to the ICU,
yeah.
A lot of times members of the interprofessional team have a burden when discussing this care.
Yeah.
Should they intubate? Should they line this patient? Should they perform all these specific drugs to sedate him?
Yeah.
Often paralyze him in certain cases postoperatively? Or should they discuss a different route?
And is your question about what language would help them have that discussion? Or
how can we prepare our colleagues to help with these conversations?
I think and this would be, Thomas would have, could talk a lot more about this, much greater depth, obviously, than I can. But this is, we can see that you have to practice. You have to form the virtues that are expressed in having those conversations in a way that's conducive to wise resolution, wise decisions, to good care for that person with the specificity of their situation. And the practice that is missing often is is the practice of seeing of seeking to discern and to talk about and encourage patients, whoever's authorized to make the decision, toward a fitting use of medicine in their situation. A use of medicine that has some reasonable prospect of obtaining some reasonably significant measure of health for them, and that does not pose for them undue burdens or other side effects. And the reason we don't practice that very well now is because of this overarching skepticism about whether medicine has any goal. It's caused us all to default to the one thing we know, which is people make choices. And the default is, for the physicians, is to lay out the options and hope and try to kind of, in a manipulative way often, encourage people who are going to make the choices to make the choice we hope they're going to make, to stop. But rarely say... because they're worried about stepping on patient autonomy, they're not making recommendations generally. They're saying things like, well, you know, this now is a time for us to talk, and we want to make sure we make the decision that you guys think is fitting, and we don't even want you to think about what you think is best. We want you to think about what he would have wanted, and they go through this kind of kabuki dance of that seems like it's just trying to get the family to have options and make a choice. But inside, what the physicians are really thinking is, my God, what are we doing? I want to stop. This seems like bad medicine. So what we have to practice is saying that, actually, in direct, plain language. I want to care for your loved one well as a physician, given my experience. Here's what I anticipate. Therefore, I recommend the following for the following reasons. Do I have your permission to do that? I will do that. Will you give me your consent? That's the kind of language you have to practice. Does that answer your question at all?
I was just going to add, it's helpful sometimes. We had a curriculum years ago for the medical students, and we would train them with some tools. For example, a lot of times our colleagues try to think, they think that these conversations are all about certainty and coming to, well, here's our decision, we've got to do this or that. And one thing that might help people is to know that conversation doesn't have to be the controller for the next forever for this patient's course. And what I'm talking about is having a conversation about time-limited trials and things. So one of the things that we do a lot in the ICU now is that we'll say, look, first off, maybe this conversation would be less about what's the matter with your father and more about what matters to your father. So flip that over. We've talked about that before in these conversations. They want to know what's the matter with, and I always flip it and say, well, what matters to him? And then you focus the attention back on what matters to this loved one who cannot speak for themselves. So that's a start in the right direction. But then the next thing that happens is you still have to come up with a decision. What are we going to do now? And it feels so final, that decision, but it doesn't have to be. We can do these time-limited trials. We can say, look, under these circumstances, it sounds like what you think he would want would be X, but you're not totally sure. So we could try this for 24 to 48 hours, and we can revisit this. And that, those time-limited trials can be very helpful. There's just a couple of tools.
Great. Yes, sir.
I'm Ricky Schmall. I'm with the Power of Paradox here. I had a comment and then a question. So I'm very sympathetic to your concern about palliative care as it's conceived, trying to essentially overtake and displace other traditions of dying well with a sort of medicalized and, frankly, metaphysically sort of impoverished idea about what dying should look like. However, I would say, at least in my practice, it has tended to be the case that it is more often not the case that palliative care is attempting to displace someone who's located in a tradition, a community that gives them a sort of rich art-oriented tradition, but rather trying to take care of people who don't have any of that, and so just trying to do something to help along that process when they don't have a tradition or a community to help them do that. So that's sort of my comment. And then my question is, in sort of your concept of trying to rein in what palliative care sees as its ambit, from everything to, you know, more traditionally medical, is how do we balance that with the fundamental recognition in hospice about total pain, and the fact that these, you know, this the approach for the students is the idea that your pain or your symptoms is not just your sort of physical being and sort of nociceptive responses, but your spiritual, social, psychological, financial, all that distress on top of it. So how do we avoid this overweening ambition to manage everything about the death, but still recognize that doing the medical part requires attention to these other things as well?
Yeah, it's a good question. Thank you for it. It reminds me that, you know, if health is, if the patient's health is the most reasonable way for physicians to orient themselves and to judge how they're going to act, even when they're palliating, then you still have the question of, well, what is health? And you can define health too broadly by making, as I think the World Health Organization does and many others do, by making health kind of that state of affairs that people most value and all the dimensions of that. You can obviously also define it too narrowly. And you can define it too narrowly when we, in palliative care, when we would maybe take just a pain score or a particular symptom as being an adequate sign that our work is done or not done. It seems to me that this is a place where our other practices in medicine give us a window into how to do this. I mean, the truth is health, because human health is the health of human beings, individuals, it always is influenced by everything that's going on, or often by all kinds of things that are going on in their life. So in the way that the concept of total pain reflects our recognition that people's suffering is more than just reducible to the firing of pain fibers. We also know that people's hypertension is affected by more than, you know, just what their lisinopril dose is. But in both cases, you don't set out your attention as a physician to someone's marriage and how it's bearing on their diabetes control is through their health. It's not because they want a good marriage, you're going to set off to make a good marriage. Does that make sense? And I think similarly, your attention to total pain, to all those things that bear on that, should be through health. How is all that you're experiencing being expressed in the well working or not well working of your of you as a whole. I'm not sure there's a fully satisfying answer there, but it seems to me that not the way to attend to whole the fact of total pain is to look to address all the dimensions of patients suffering with medical means, particularly not the means of benzodiazepines, narcotics, and tranquilizers. Yes?
So, in the case of A, you said he comes back 2 weeks after getting his diagnosis and he asks for a prescription to end his life if he chooses to use it. As a physician, do you try and change his mind, or and do you try to bring him into your frame
yeah.
of mind, or do you give up on him, or how do you balance that?
Yeah, I think what you don't do as a physician is give up on someone, or at least you don't stop making yourself available to them with a commitment to care for them. But neither do you give up on your commitments as a physician. So, and it's not just asking doctors to cause their death. I mean, patients ask us to do things all the time that, to the best of our knowledge, our frail, limited human knowledge, are not good for them, are not good for their health. And we don't do what they ask often. It's not controversial when we refuse antibiotics for a virus, but it seems more controversial when we start to get into these morally contentious topics. So when Abe asked that for me, of course, want to ask him, tell me what's going on, why are you saying, what's behind that? But when push comes to shove, I'm going to tell Abe frankly, and respectfully, Abe, listen, as your doctor, I'm not going to aim at your death. I don't think you dying is a good thing. I'm also not going to try to keep you alive forever because I recognize your health may not be much of a concern to you at this point. But as a physician, I want to pursue your health in the way that you'll give me permission to and that fits your situation, in my judgment and in yours. And this is a practice I'm not going to engage in as your physician. Yes. Hey, Jess.
Sorry, I'll try and speak up.
Thanks.
So I really appreciated your discussion about kind of the transition from like the distinctions that you wanted to make between palliative care and palliative medicine, particularly in regards to cultural and longstanding precedents regarding norms and things that we've always thought about that. One question I had for you is so I'm on the palliative care service right now, and I said to one of my attending physicians today, I cannot believe how much of your job is educating people and telling them what death is, like what it's like to die.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering when you had been thinking about these, I know that since these argument-oriented concepts were created, people were a lot more exposed to death and had a lot better idea of what death actually is than they do now. Somebody can be dying and not know what it is or not know what happens. And I can, assure you that most people in the building have probably never actually seen somebody die. And so when you're thinking about this and thinking about those cultural norms, how did you take that into
account? It's a factor that maybe helps to explain why... Woody Allen famously said, I'm not afraid of dying. I just don't want to be there when it happens. And there's a lot of... Behind that is something I think we can all resonate with. I could sort of... None of us can really think our deaths. We can't take that in. But there's a kind of being able to live with the reality that we all know that we're all going to die. It's a stunning, still, to me, outrageous fact. It's very hard to grapple with, but it's true. But when it's right up close, it's pretty overwhelming for people. And probably it made even more overwhelming by, as you said, the fact that most people, have not seen someone die. And that is a new thing, that in times past you would have seen your grandmother die in the front parlor, and you would have seen your little sister die of a meningitis when she was 2 years old. There was a lot more death, which was a bad thing. So I think it basically maybe contributes to a reaction to dying that where we see making someone not there existentially when they're dying, like making them unconscious as a goal in itself, perhaps because we just don't want to. We're not. We haven't learned that we can go on in the face of dying, present to dying, unless you're one of those rare people who works in palliative care. Yes.
Can you tell us an example of how you would use your own language about how medicine is there for healing? When somebody, let's say, I did ask you for this prescription, he wanted you to give him a prescription to kill him, and you said no. To convert him from a feeling of you have abandoned me, you're not doing what I ask, how would you use your own language to show him that you're actually still striving towards healing and lifting him up, even though you're doing it by telling him no?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing is, it seems to me that by telling him no, I am communicating to him that I'm not abandoning him. And that's paradoxical, because many people kind of intuitively think, oh, you're abandoning him because you're not going to go with him there. Timothy Quill has argued this in many places, that you got to go where patients need to go. And if you're not going to go there, you're in effect sort of saying, I'm not going to be with you in that. To me, that seems self-contradictory insofar as to cause a patient's death is to end your presence with them. It's to deliberately put an end to their presence and to you. So what I communicate to people, and I live in North Carolina where this is not going to be legal in the short term, but I've had several people over the years ask the question, like, can you do something to, you know, help me end this? Or do often more, frankly, much more common, it's families, can you do something to end this? It's taking too long. Is just to communicate, you know, I'm going to walk with you the whole way, and I will attend to I'm talking to Abe and he's conscious. I will attend to the symptoms you're experiencing, to however your health is affected. I will do what I can to be helpful along the way. I'll be there. I'm not going to leave you languishing in pain out of an abstemiousness about crossing a moral boundary, but I'm not going to set out to make you dead. And that doesn't mean that everybody is persuaded by that. Some people are going to say, well, I got to find a new doctor. Yes?
So what you just said about that oftentimes being the family, it makes me think about the way that it seems very easy, kind of in the calculus that we use in our very comfortable lives, to think of suffering as the greatest possible evil. Does that change? Does that calculus shift when people are faced with their own death? Do they become more receptive to this idea of health as you've defined it, rather than health is just the absence of suffering, or are they resistant to that usually?
That's a good question. When people are dying, I don't know that they're thinking in the abstract in a way. The important way of thinking in the abstract that we're doing tonight, trying to get clear on the concepts and principles and the norms. What very concretely I observe is that people greatly appreciate, even as they're dying and even as they're being diminished in their capacity steadily, right? They're becoming paralyzed. They're losing their ability to walk. They can't eat anymore. They need a catheter. They appreciate still the things that remain, I've observed. So they still appreciate often being able to eat, even though they have to have a catheter and can't walk. They appreciate the ability to be alert, even though they can't eat and have need a catheter and can't walk, and so on. And so in that respect, I find that people are able to see, when they're diminished, the goodness of dimensions of their health that are not lost fully, even when those are both decreased and when many other dimensions are lost. And I think I'll take the opportunity here to say something about the phenomenon of people like Brittany Maynard. Do anybody remember Brittany Maynard? She was a young woman in California, this beautiful, you know, late 20s-ish woman who had developed a glioblastoma and a brain cancer. And she famously, in cooperation with the organization Compassion and Choices, publicly wrote a kind of journal that was published on CNN and went viral. And she said, you know, I'm moving to Oregon to avail myself of death with dignity. So she became the poster child for the death with dignity movement. What was striking about her is long before she actually lost the capacities, she concluded that to lose those capacities would be unacceptable to her. It would be a life that she could not live and could not accept. And that seems to me a characteristic phenomenon, that the people who are most, for example, enthusiastic about assisted dying are people who had not had to live with many diminishments. You don't find the disabled arguing, please kill us. You just don't. You don't find the poor arguing, please let us, we need an access to ability to die. You do not find that. You don't find African-American community saying, we want assisted suicide. You don't find immigrants asking for it. What you find is generally people who've had great lives where they had so much choice and they've not had to suffer very much, and the prospect of being diminished and suffering and not having anything to do that's worthwhile is one that's just unacceptable. And so they want the chance to, the promise that they can exit when they feel like that condition has become unacceptable to them.
We had a Vanderbilt student last year get a fellowship and went around the world and studied end of life in 22 countries. And in every industrialized country, what you just said was so exactly spot on. She would have these great complicated conversations about why people wanted assisted suicide. And when she went to the developing nations, they were like, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah, it just doesn't cross the mind.
That's not even a question.
Yeah. People living with suffering their whole lives. And with finding that, you know, life, there's still goods available to you, even when you're poor, even when you're disabled, even when you're living under tremendous stress, your life is still worth living. And I think that physicians of all people need to manifest solidarity with those who are suffering and weakened and debilitated and socially marginalized and everything else. They ought to be able to say that at least physicians have committed, even if the physicians don't even feel it internally, they've committed that they're going to treat them as if it's good that they're around in their diminished state. And one way to do that is to say, we're never going to try to kill you. Not even if you ask us to, because your family is encouraging you to ask, or because you feel worthless, or anything else. One last question, yes?
So I feel like these would be ethically difficult studies, but other than studies showing that reduced treatment with opioids, with sedatives, with antipsychotics, lead to better dying, according to like what you were saying, which would be a bit more qualitative, a bit more like surveys to families and patients about how they feel about dying?
That's a good question. It is a fact that insofar as the studies have been done, as I see them, people who receive hospice care and palliative care, their families rate their experience more favorably than do people who do not. Now, whether would be the study to do would be, what about two groups, one that operates with an intention to pursuing relief of symptoms within this orientation to the patient's health objectively understood, and those that see them, their goal is to reduce quality of life according to the wishes of the patients using these tools. That's a great study. It'd be hard to do, but I'm not aware that kind of analysis has been done. I'll just one last anecdote. I was very recently talking to a colleague who lost a child tragically to an illness recently, and the colleague doesn't practice medicine, but knows about medical ethics issues, and told me that this colleague was deeply disturbed by their experience of the way palliative care unfolded with them, and that the colleague said that as palliative care occurred for their child, as they experienced it, no consideration was given as to what the side effects of these drugs were, and the only thing that seemed the doctors treat it as of attention is the question of comfort. And comfort pursued with high doses of drugs, even when the kid had no evidence of having discomfort. Do I think those doctors are trying to kill that patient? No. But it does seem to me that that's in just the sort of example of the way that a monocular focus on comfort that sets aside the norms that physicians normally attend to will lead us down a pathway toward easing people out without even really realizing what we're doing. Thank you all.
Thank you.